Teddy Wilson opening up this afternoon's fresh air with Cole Porter's I Get a Kick Out of You. Well, Mondays at 4 o'clock until the end of the year, we're featuring the series The Musical Stage with John Johnson, and on today's show, we'll hear the first in a series devoted to the songs of Rodgers and Hart. Fresh Air's arts reviewer Judy Stein will be with us at her regular Monday time, 3:40, for her weekly review of museum and gallery shows. And Dan Lusk will review another small literary press publication at 3:30 on this week's edition of Off the Wall. Billy Milligan was arrested for rape in 1977. He became the first person ever found not guilty of a major crime by reason of insanity because of multiple personality. You may have read about Milligan in yesterday's Inquirer in the Today magazine section. He has, it's estimated, 24 personalities, and he's either a brilliant hoax or one of the most complex examples of this mysterious disorder. Daniel Keyes, in cooperation with Milligan, his doctors, lawyers, and family, has written a new book called The Minds of Billy Milligan, and Keyes will be with us at about 2:45 or 3 o'clock. Since the 1979 revolution, which overthrew the Somoza regime in Nicaragua, the U.S. has perceived Nicaragua as an unfriendly and threatening force in Central America. Yesterday, Secretary of State Alexander Haig said, quote, "We have not given up on Nicaragua, but the hours are growing short," unquote. When asked what means he'd used to prevent the drift towards totalitarianism in Nicaragua, Haig said, quote, "We don't discount any possibilities," unquote. During the revolution in Nicaragua, writer and poet Richard Ellman traveled there with photographer Susan Mizales to write an article for the first issue of GEO magazine. 1 year later, after the revolution was won by the Sandinistas, Ellman returned, this time independently, to see the results of the revolution and to see old friends. His impressions of both trips are recorded in his latest book called Cocktails at Somoza's, a reporter's sketchbook of events in revolutionary Nicaragua. You may also know Richard Ellman from his political commentaries on All Things Considered. He's the former news and public affairs director at the listener-supported Pacifica station in New York, WBAI. His other books have been about such subjects as life in the new suburbs and touring with the Rolling Stones. He's the author of the novelization of Taxi Driver and has written books of poems, including Homage to Fats Navarro. Ellman is now a visiting professor of creative writing at the University of Pennsylvania. Welcome to Fresh Air.
Hi.
Before we talk about some of your other writing and some of the other projects you'd worked on, let's talk about your recent trips to Nicaragua. Why did you go the first time? Since you're a poet, you're not you've written journalism, but you're not a full-time political journalist.
No, I went because I'd never been to a war or a revolution before. And the only language that I have is Spanish, and I do have always translated a lot of Spanish poetry, and I've always been interested in Central American poetry, and of course Nicaragua has had great poets, so I've always been interested in Nicaragua. And of course, up until the revolution really got underway in Nicaragua, there was very little that one ever read in the newspapers about what was happening in Nicaragua, and then suddenly I began to read things. The New York Times had a quite good man there, Alan Riding. And Alan's dispatches would become more and more interesting, and I just got intrigued. And when I had an opportunity to go, when GEO started, they had some pictures that they wanted to print, and they had nothing to accompany the pictures. So I volunteered to go, and they said, well, you're not that type of a writer. And I said, well, I'll be that type of a writer. Let me go. So I went.
What kind of protection did you feel you had as a journalist?
Well, I had the protection of credentials from La Prensa, which was the opposition newspaper, and that meant, that wasn't protection. In some ways, that put me in jeopardy, but what it meant was that I had access to people who were close to the revolution. I also got GEO to make sure to give me some kind of document which I could show to the Somoza government, which meant that they had to acknowledge that I was a member of the press and supposedly treat me with all due respect, which didn't mean that they wouldn't occasionally send their soldiers through my hotel room looking for various things, armed, and it didn't also mean that they didn't try to intimidate me and other people in other ways, strafing at our vehicles to keep us from going down various roads. And the from the insurgents, we never had very much to fear. They were very glad to have us there. They wanted as much coverage as they could get.
Why do you think they wanted it, whereas the Somoza regime was so antagonistic to journalists?
Well, they wanted it because it was the only way they could tell their story to the world. They had, if you have power, you're not so anxious, and you have power and abuse power the way the Somozas do, you're not so anxious to tell your story to the world anyway. the less coverage, the better, I think they might have felt. Moreover, they tended to regard all journalists as dangerous left-wingers. And I would say that of the world press who was there, it's true that after a while, most of them were more or less sympathetic. Most of them, not with some exceptions. The man from the Reader's Digest was certainly an exception. But most of them were fairly sympathetic to some change taking place in Nicaragua. And they were appalled at the atrocities. And the atrocities were very evident.
Do you think that most of the people there were interested in change because of what they'd witnessed while they were there, or do you think they already came down being for it?
No, I think a lot of people were radicalized. I know of cases where that happened. Now, how far that carried beyond, I can't speak about, but a lot of people's views changed because I know my views changed, and I suppose I was on the left. But I'd never seen a revolution. I didn't know what was going to be happening, what I was going to be witnessing in terms of human behavior. And I had my head was filled with as many cliches as the next person's. And one saw acts of desperate heroism. One saw rather rational behavior when one least expected to find rational behavior. And one saw terrible, terrible atrocities. So that, you know, does make an impact. I mean, I got very angry, finally. And I wrote things for anybody who would publish them. I was there to do only one piece. And it gave me a great leisure. If I wanted to, I could have goofed off a lot. But I'm not that type of person. But and the piece had to be written fast when I got up, when I left. I really couldn't write it beforehand. I kept notes, but I got so angry at some of the things that I saw that I more or less started giving my stuff away in the I couldn't sell it to anybody because that would have violated my contract with Geo. So I just gave it away to radio station. I used to call up the Pacifica station in Berkeley, collect and just talk on the air to them. They record it, you know, just do reports twice a day. I gave stuff away to whatever magazines would print what I was seeing because I felt it was important to tell the story of what was going on and important to counter the cliches of the press. I mean, I wrote an article at one point about the press and how the press views revolution. They tend to think that there are just ringleaders and nobody else, for example, and that all the rest of the people don't really have political ideas or thoughts or anything. They're just sheep. And they tend to write stories that say something like that. And the consequence was that, for example, in Nicaragua, I would attend press conferences with Susan Micellus, for example, or without Susan, and we'd be the only members of the press who were there because the people who were running this press conference had not been recognized by the press. They happened to be very important people. They were organizing the barrios in ways that were later proved to be terribly effective in winning the revolution. But at that point, nobody bothered to think that there was anything going on in the barrios of that kind. So nobody talked to them. And they were talking, you know, they represented sizable factions within the country. So that's what I mean, a lot of times the press, I mean, I think at times they did a terrific job in Nicaragua, and I'm not criticizing on that level, and a heroic job at times. I'm just saying that their vision of what goes on in a situation is influenced by their prejudices, by their hack, by their cliches.
Did you get a chance to talk to many of those reporters who you know
wrote
that way? Do you think that they personally held those cliches to be true, or was it pressure from their paper to write
both.
That way?
Both. Now, it really varies from person to person and place to place. And some, as I say, many of them really broke through that, and they saw things with their eyes that they'd never believed they'd see, and they couldn't help but report it and tell the truth. And the camera people are even more heroic and remarkable to me because they have to get so close and actually look.
It's lately been some of the camera people who've been getting killed. When
sure. Susan got blown up in a Jeep in El Salvador.
Yeah, I'd read about that. So you were reporting there, and you said you'd never been in a revolution before. What were some of the ideas or the goals that held together all the people who saw themselves as fighting it?
Well, in the case of Nicaragua, which may be the difference between Nicaragua, for example, and El Salvador, that there was this massive, unified loathing and hatred of the dynasty, of the Somoza dynasty, and what it represented in terms of how it developed the country for its own, as its own plantation. Now, when I say the difference between Salvador is that there isn't such a visible figure, insofar as I know, who brings this out in the people the same way, or dynasty, really. There are, we're told, 13 families and so on and so forth. But some very reactionary or conservative and certainly well-heeled members of the establishment joined with the left and with the agrarian proletariat, and there was great unity at some point along the way. It has not lasted entirely, but that was one thing. And then there were various visions of what Nicaragua could be, and they were based on, again, on some very different. There were some people who really wanted Nicaragua, really thought that what the future of Nicaragua was, and it's something that I'm very sympathetic with, I don't know whether it's realizable, is to be like Costa Rica. Prosperous, liberal democracy in Central America. There are others who really wanted to revolutionize the social structure and the structure of ownership of property and so on and so forth. In fact, the revolution has done some of that, but not very much of it. It's expropriated Somoza's lands, which were substantial, and turned those over. But much private property remains in private hands, and that includes business, too. There were those who saw the necessity for immediate kind of Marxist-Leninist state, and there were those who were very much opposed to that. And they, for a moment, somehow held together. What I'm saying is, against the Somozas and against the U.S. And let's face it, there was tremendously strong. When Mr. Haig says that the Nicaraguans are not acting in a friendly way to the U.S., he's accurate. They are not, and indeed, they have good reason not to be, from their history, to be trustful or anything else of the U.S. And since the U.S. backed Somoza's until the last possible moment, it was directed to a large degree against the notion of the U.S. empire in that sense. Not the U.S., not so much the U.S. as that country in North America, but the U.S. as this thing that controls so much of Central and South America and so much of the world banking situation. And that's certainly the case.
When you returned to Nicaragua after the revolution, did the people who the friends who you had made when you were there before seem satisfied or with the way things were going? Did they seem confident that
some did.
The new government was going to continue to make
those progress? Who had been on the lowest economic scale tended to be more enthusiastic than others. But even that varies, too. The dissatisfactions were and are, I think, insofar as I know about them, various. There are Catholics who are dissatisfied because of they feel that the official ideology of the revolution has become Marxist-Leninism, and that this means that their children are being indoctrinated as Marxist-Leninists in the schools, there, etc., and that whole panoply of things. There is the middle class who defected from Somoza and were very effective and very important in what happened, because when that middle class defected, that meant that when a general strike was called, as it was, no businesses operated. I mean, nothing moved in Managua or anywhere else. Money was being generated. I think that some of them feel very insecure on the level of what the future means for them. Some of them feel insecure because they're not making enough money. They like to make money, they're not making enough money because of some things that have happened, and also because of all the destruction that took place. But what happened is that, for example, in terms of labor, if you run a business there and you have a labor force, that labor force is not only organized and makes demands on you, which they would do anywhere, but those demands have become increasingly militant, although not that militant. But the other thing is that they now have the right to make managerial decisions with you. That is to say, you sit down with your employees and with your executives and with the labor union too. And it's kind of a veto situation. And a lot of people in Nicaragua were very upset about a lot of those kind of people were very upset about that. It's not a way they would want to run a business. If I were a businessman, I doubt if I'd want to run it. The odd thing is, you see, that the Nicaraguan government keeps saying that they want to keep this class, and yet they are sort of breaking them a little bit, you know, making it very hard for them to function as they once did. Well, it doesn't seem to me likely that they're going to be that you can expect a businessman to be self-sacrificing. So that kind of dissatisfaction. Then, of course, they do. The new Sandinistan government does have a virtual, I say virtual because it's not in fact, entire monopoly over the press and publishing and so on and so forth. So people who are concerned, who are working in those areas and who are not considered loyal or no, not even loyal, who are not saying what they would like them to say, don't find it easy to get their words printed or their things published.
This isn't the first time we've seen that happen in a revolutionary society, and it's something that disappoints many people who have some conviction about the need for change, and then to find out that the groups responsible for changing it and for overthrowing one regime might institute really harsh measures themselves, like absence of freedom of the press.
Well, it's an interesting thing to me because, of course, La Prensa, which was the great newspaper of Nicaragua, and at one time was one of the great newspapers of Central America, and was founded by the Chamorro family, and Pedro Joaquin Chamorro, who was the editor, actually led a number of revolts against Somoza himself and was eventually killed by the Somozas, and that was an important event in the revolution. That newspaper, which was crucial to the revolutionary cause in a lot of ways, is now considered the enemy by the new government. Now, it isn't as good a newspaper as it was, but that's for other reasons. It's still a much, much more interesting newspaper and a much better newspaper than the government newspaper. What happened was the Nicaraguan government took over Somoza's newspaper, Novedades, which was a terrible rag, and I mean, an awful, vicious rag, and are running their own propaganda sheet on it. And when they close, they keep closing La Prensa, which is, I think, outrageous. And when they close it, every time they say, well, you see, they knowingly are printing lies. And I don't know whether that's true or not, but if that was the criterion on which to close a newspaper in Nicaragua, I would think that Barricada would be closed every day of the week. I mean,
Well, here's another example of the absence of freedom of the press. When you were flying for the second time to Nicaragua, the woman in front of you had a copy of Playboy as well as some other American magazines, and they confiscated and then ripped up the copy of Playboy, calling it imperialist pornography.
Yeah, yeah.
And you were very disturbed.
I certainly was. I don't like to see that happen. On the other hand, I would like you to understand that compared to Cuba, for example, compared probably to Paraguay or a few other places I could name in that part of the world, at the moment, the abuses that are going on in Nicaragua are still not on that level. So in terms of that issue. There is still La Prensa. It does get published. There is one radio station that does do what they want to do. There is no independent publishing operation, however, which is a scandal, because that means that the only poems that get published are the only novels, if they indeed do get published novels, are things that one man decides are worth doing. But it has to be viewed in a context, I think. And I do think that it could change with the Nicaraguan people can change it. Alexander Haig couldn't care less. He talks about these things, but he doesn't give a damn about that. I mean, he's worried because Nicaragua was a successful consolidation of power in Central America opposed to the United States. He wouldn't care whether they flogged people there. But that's what concerns him, that there are a successful consolidation of power, which the United States doesn't control, and that there is another such action taking place in El Salvador, which the U.S. cannot seem to get under control, and another such operation, which is getting very, very bloody, taking place in Guatemala, where there are atrocities the likes of which they didn't even have in Nicaragua, and where they've just discovered enormous amounts of oil. Guatemala, it's estimated, has an oil pool that's almost as large as what they found in Chiapas and Tabasco in Mexico. So they are really, they're concerned. It has nothing to do with, I mean, he talks about that, but that's not what I think they're really interested in.
Speaking with Richard Ellman, if you're just joining us, and he spent some time in Nicaragua and has recently written a book called Cocktails at Somoza's, which is his reflections during the revolution and on his return trip after the revolution. You had a lot of friends that you made from your first trip who you visited again on your mm-hmm. second trip. How did their day-to-day lives change after the revolution was completed?
Mm. Some, as I say, one young woman who I knew, who was more or less a drifter in the fringes of the revolution, became a journalist for the Barricada, which is the revolutionary newspaper, and went to live in a revolutionary commune. She was a upper middle class, I would have said. Her father had been a general in the National Guard. So they had money and all that, but she was somewhat alienated from the family. So she went and lived in a kind of communal situation and was part of the inner circles of the outer circles of the inner circles of the outer circles of the Sandinistan power elite. A young man I knew who was a Bluefields Negro, that's an important distinction because the east coast of Nicaragua is largely black and English-speaking, Creole English-speaking, and he was one such person. And it was partially because he was English-speaking, ended up with a minor job in the foreign ministry. Another friend of mine who was a poet and a writer has fearfully been trying to get his work published without much luck. His house was destroyed by the revolution, and he was living with relatives, and his whole family, he and his family were living with relatives, and he was really, I don't think he's ever quite gotten over it in any way, and there were people who were living with him who were still walking around shell-shocked, dazed, 3 or 4 months after it was over. It really does depend on individuals. I did get great pleasure, though, out of seeing things like peasants near Montélimar, which is this elegant estate that Somoza had, riding around in their fields on very elegant stable horses that had obviously been liberated from the Somoza families. I imagine that must have been a considerable change in their life to have a horse. They didn't have them before. Many people stayed in the army, and a little bit like in Israel, you know, they stayed in the defense force. They were needed. They're building an enormous defense constabulary, 40,000 troops. To tell you how much that is, you have to realize that Somoza had 10 to 15,000 at the height of the revolution, and he ran that country with that many. So they're building a tremendous, and some of that is I think, real fearfulness. They're very fearful. I mean, one of the big things that I get in mail from my friends down there now is how fearful they are of what's going to happen. They're fearful of the U.S. doing a number of some kind, like they did in Guatemala in the 50s, or tried to do in Cuba in the 60s. They talk about it. After all, there are 10,000 American troops in the Canal Zone. It doesn't seem likely to me that they would be very successful at doing it, because there is a seasoned and well-trained, well-armed force there, so they're scared of that. At first, food was fairly plentiful, right, afterwards. But again, there have been shortages of food more recently. I've heard about that. East Coast people are pretty upset by the government in general, because it's a Spanish imposition, they regard it. It's a Spanish Catholic communist government imposed on them, and they tend to be Protestant. If anything, spiritist, more likely English, Creole-speaking, black. And they don't really want to be disciplined or organized, they claim. They certainly could use a lot of the social services and medical facilities. It was never developed in that sense at all. Well, most of Nicaragua was never developed in that sense. Enormous numbers of people learned how to read. They had a very successful literacy campaign, and that's no small feat. I mean, it... Am I answering your question? I don't know.
Yeah, well, having experienced what you did firsthand, do you now have more or less faith in revolution or revolutionary societies? Because it sounds like this one's getting mixed reviews, that there's a lot of things that have changed for the better, a lot of things that you're also disappointed in. It's still the new system is very young, and it might be difficult to judge it. And it sounds like they're also very defensive now, because they're afraid of being overturned by outside forces.
I'm a socialist, and I don't really think that what happens is necessarily inevitable. I mean, I don't think that when things go bad, that's necessarily inevitable, or even when things happen well, that's inevitable. I mean, it happens because human beings do it. And I do think that it would be worth that the Nicaraguan Revolution was something that was unique and important, and that getting rid of the Somoza dynasty was a major accomplishment of a people. I think that Nicaragua has a lot of struggling to do to figure out how to create a just and prosperous society. And I think, you see, that's which I find important, is it seems to me Nicaragua could be a prosperous society. And that's what nobody ever says. It's a potentially rich, fertile country. It's not very populated. There are only 2 million people living in an area about the size of Vermont and New Hampshire, maybe even a little larger, I believe. There are a lot of growing seasons, a lot of stuff in the ground. It was very badly ripped off, and it was left with a legacy of over $1.5 billion worth of debts. And so that since they have wanted in their own way to be part of the international community, do business, in other words, they're going to have to service that debt all the time, which is draining enormous amounts of potential from the country. I'm not interested myself in the socialism of scarcity and stoicism. I'm interested in the socialism of plenty, of paradise on earth. And I sometimes think that when I listen to what's being said, that they're stepping a long ways from that. I mean, they're not thinking about, in those terms, they're asking for sacrifice. And I don't think one should ask people to sacrifice. They only have one life.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't know whether I'm answering your question.
Oh,
but,
sure.
I haven't been there in a few years, but I'm very, very fond of Costa Rica. And why I'm fond of certain aspects of it is because the feeling that even though it's not a revolutionary situation, people are getting something for what they're putting in. And I'm sure that could happen in Nicaragua too.
Could you write us a couple of your poems about Nicaragua? And my guest is Richard Ellman, if you're just joining us, and you might also recognize his voice from his commentaries on All Things Considered. His book, by the way, about Nicaragua is called Cocktails at Somoza's, and he visits Philadelphia, I guess, about once a week now as a visiting professor of creative writing at the University of Pennsylvania.
This is called In Chontales. Chontales is a small town in Nicaragua, and this poem was written after I'd driven there and spent some time there. And Chontales also refers to Chontal Mayan. The Mayan civilization reached down to that part of Nicaragua. The woman wakes before first light, grinds corn in her metat and stows the patty cakes and palm leaves to go off again to the marketplace. After 5 miles or more, she will sell tortillas to the laborers from town, moving like early morning ghosts to go off to their fields. And then she must walk home, empty-handed again. All day long in a sun, warmer than her own poor thin blood, she stoops to her work. Her children all grow thinner. Life is a short pain between oblivions. Even the barnyard animals are better fed than she, and sometimes they can rest. How she would like to rest, too, in deep shade somewhere, beside a pool of limpid and cool water. Then she might dream herself a fine fat fowl with angel wings, as in the church, sprockets of plumage and a corn-pecking strut. But now again she has clothing to mend, to wash, water to fetch, cooking, fixing, gathering, selling, the fullness of her wants and fears, her life. At noon she'll go to the fields with food for her husband. While he eats, it's her turn to lean heavily over his hoe. Women such as this have put the dust of so many lives into their one pinching gnaw of a life, and yet they remain measly, meager, wan, as a scar of that dust. At night when she finally rests, the lantern light still rusts on the shelf above her pillow. And when she gets up to blow it out, this one dreams for a moment in the darkness. Jesus himself, in long white robes, has asked her to paseo with him under all these scented trees in Chontales Plaza, and then he will whisper in her ears the many dark, uncouth urgings of the paramour. But matrimony intrudes, which is like one more chore for her husband she can't refuse, though sometimes there's a little pleasure. And then she will measure out the day she has left to her life like handfuls of dry corn and maybe fall off to sleep a little as though she were already dead. This is called... Can I read it now?
Yeah, I wish you would.
This is called Calle El Progreso, Nicaragua. Right outside the door of this thick little house, soldiers are shooting people. If I stick my head out there, I'll be dead. In this thick little war on the streets, the guard patrols from a point downtown with tanks against shotguns. And their rockets and bombs rock the baby in her cradle. Up the street, some rebels are asleep behind barricades. Airplanes overhead in a perfectly neutral blue sky nose the silence, which has dropped heavily down when the shooting stopped. And whether I like it or not, I'm in the middle in the house of this small, fat grocer, hating this National Guard, but loving my life too well to walk uptown right now and go behind the barricades. Here we are all behind the flimsy rebel lines of paving blocks. Yesterday, in León, on the Calle Rubén Darío, that long black sleeve of tar was severed at the elbow by some guardsmen standing in a street corner with their guns pointed like public workers pushing pneumatic drills. In Masaya, city of weavers, traces shuttled patterns of light and smoke on ether. The marketplace ablaze, and all the fruit gives off an odor of roasting flesh. May I read one more?
Yeah. Okay. Have your poems been translated in Nicaragua yet?
They've been translated into Spanish, and you can buy this little book in Nicaragua, which is nice, but no, they haven't been. This is one I wrote after leaving the first time. It has a Spanish word in the title. Peligroso means dangerous. And then at the bottom, it refers to something called a galil. A galil is an Israeli automatic rifle which was sold in large quantities to the National Guard of Nicaragua. It's a very good assault weapon. Peligroso, warned the guard, pointing his weapon at my heart. Outside the war, a slower world began, beyond the speed of sound, moving above slow clouds, a bullet charged with contradictory particles. So much for dying. We drank champagne at 30,000 feet with the ambassador's wife. Her breasts were like amber. Her heart was embalmed in resin, too. For she told me talk of bodies rotting on the streets in Esteli could make entertaining the right people in Washington this coming season difficult. Oh, she said, you must not believe we are all as self-absorbed and cruel as they say we are, sucking the moment on her amber brooch and then a black olive, as she offered me her breasts and her hips, her excellent perfume, and the musk of her desire, in a handful of rebel dust. In Washington, our wheels set down like galils firing near the cemetery wall at my rebel friends in Monimbo when I thought, by the crater lake, by the waters of Messiah, where I sat down, then did I cry as I remembered Zion.
Thanks for reading those. Richard Ellman is my guest, and he's a poet and novelist and journalist. If I might just change the subject for a few minutes, we've been talking about, you've read some of your poems, and we've been talking about the time that you spent in Nicaragua. And I'd just like to take out a couple of minutes before we run out of time to find out about a very different project, mm-hmm. which is the novelization that you wrote of the film Taxi Driver. And it's... How did novelizations get written? How did you get hooked up with that project?
Well, I was writing poetry. I was writing this Homage to Fats Navarro book, what became that book, and I was trying to keep away from doing any writing other than that. And at the time I had an agent who was a real go-getter. And the man who wrote the Taxi Driver, Paul Schrader, apparently had read something of mine, and he was trying to get in touch with me, and she had instructions not to have him get in touch with me. And finally, he said, look, this is a lot of money for a very little bit of work, and he'd probably enjoy doing it. So she got in touch with me and asked me if I could, as she could be sarcastic sometimes, if I could consider not doing my poems for a little while in order to make a living. So I said, well, how much of a living? And she named a figure, and it was a very nice figure. And I said, well, it's not enough. So they, at that point, they increased it quite a bit. And she said, there, how's that? And I said, well, what does it involve? I had never done one of these things. She said, well, all we want you to do is spend a month, because you can't take longer than a month, because we need it in a month, and read the thing through and make a little novel out of it, and just use the same characters. Do whatever you want with it, but just use the same characters. So I said, well, you mean I can do put in anything I want? And she said, yes, you can put in anything you want. So I did, and I took a month, and I had a good time doing it. That's all I did for that month. I dictated it because I didn't have time to write it into a machine. And I made a lot of money. I mean, for me, I don't make lots of money, but I mean, it was good money for what for me, and I get royalties on it to this day. It appears in all kinds of things. And it's become a kind of thing that I do once in a while when I need money. I've now done four of them, not only Taxi Driver.
Which others?
Well, the latest that's out on the stands, I only use my name for Taxi Driver because they gave me royalties. And since they're giving me royalties and I had a good deal and I figured I'll sign my name, but I haven't signed my name to any others. The one I did most recently, I signed the name Delmar Hanks. And that's Smokey and the Bandit Parts 1 and Parts 2. Last year I did one called The Gangster Chronicles under the name Michael Lasker. Which was the name of one of the characters in it. I never do them and never take longer than a month because I don't really want to take off. If you do them for longer than a month, it's not worthwhile. I figure I gain two additional months to write poems or whatever I want by working for a month on one of these things. And so it's okay. I mean, you know, if you don't mind... I mean, most of the stuff that I get is really dreadful, and therefore that gives me the freedom to dreck it up any way I want, and I do, and I put in my poems in the middle of them, and I do all kinds of things that, you know, whatever I can get away with, and I do try and... I regard it as a critique of the movie. I mean, I tend to regard the thing as a critique of the movie.
What did you change in Taxi Driver?
Didn't so much change it, but I didn't like the fact that I didn't feel he had any motivation for being so violent. So I made him into a real Vietnam vet. I mean, who had really been in trouble in Vietnam, and I really played up that element of it. And the other thing I thought that. The Sybil Shepherd character had to be pretty off the wall too. If she would consider going out with a guy like that, so I figured she had some problems of her own. So I did something about that too, and I gave him a very unique prose. I think it becomes actually it's rather well written in places. I think I mean he when he does the murder. See, I don't have a television camera and all that. So what do you do? So I made the prose really vivid, I mean, very vivid and stream of consciousness, kind of fast stream of consciousness, very repetitive. And I think it's very good. I know it's good because the translators in the various languages have a hell of a time translating that particular passage. You know, it's all slangy and...
Did you leave in the line, "Are you talking to me?" which became the most quoted line from the movie?
Oh, yeah.
We were wondering how that translates to other languages. Such a colloquialism. What did you do with the ending of it? I always imagine the end myself to be some kind of fantasy sequences where he's a hero and Sybil Shepherd comes.
No, I left it that way.
Do you see that as being a fantasy sequence also?
Oh, I did something. I had them both in... They meet again, uh-huh. And I have them both in therapy.
which kind of therapy?
They just say that I'm, you know, in effect, it's clear that they're both getting help for their problems. I mean, I figured... The other thing I don't like is to glorify psychopaths. Uh-huh. I mean, I really resented doing... So I tried to avoid glorifying that particular particular thing. But you'd have to read it. It is really quite different. I mean, I think it's quite different and bawdier in a certain way. I mean, I have really bawdy stuff in it. All kinds of bawdy stuff about all the leading celebrities of the day who we think, you know, guys like that, they tend to worry about the sex lives of Mrs. Kennedy and so on and so forth. I have all that. He's all his thoughts about that and his diaries. He keeps a diary. I do it as a diary, like Arthur Bremer's diary,
right.
or something like that. But as I say, I only had a month to do it, and I really wanted to make it happen very fast. And I didn't even have the script. So you see, I had a kind of a script, but it wasn't a full script. I had a kind of pre-shooting script. It was an outline with a few scenes in it. So I really didn't have much to work from. I knew the storyline and the plot, and I knew from the scenes that were there how I was supposed to treat the character. But I didn't really have a strong sense, and I wasn't particularly thrilled with it.
Yeah.
I wasn't thrilled with the story or the movie. I saw the damn thing, and I went to some of the shooting, but I've never. That was the only time I went to the shooting. The other things I never have gone to the shooting of, but I don't know. It didn't, to me, look like New York when I saw it. I mean, it didn't look like New York City. It looked like somebody photographing who said to make it look like New York, but it didn't look like New York. It didn't look like the city that I have lived in most of my life and know pretty well. So I really tried to do that with a voice to give a sense of that New York. And in my version, it opens up. I'll tell you that. It opens up, and he's standing outside a porn theater. And there's a guy standing outside the porn theater with him who's a musician at liberty, he says. And it's cold, snowy kind of day, and the guy has a cold sore on his lip. And my character, Travis Bickle, can't say cold sore, so he says he has a cold slore on his lip. I always liked that, a cold slore on his lip. That's the opening scene. It's an entirely different opening than
mm-hmm.
theirs.
Mm-hmm. Well, we're really out of time, but we're about to hear a recording with trumpeter Chet Baker, who I know is someone whose music you've enjoyed, and you've written a poem about him that I'd like to ask you to close with.
Sure.
This is from Richard Ellman's collection, Homage to Fats Navarro.
It's called Chet's Jazz. The jamming together of fragments, puffed through a failing wind, reiterates such sounds as can extenuate the hurt lips on the caved-in face. If you could see me now, sings the ghost of pretty boy Chet, faintly flirtatious. And when he blows again, he goes up and down on tiptoes, as if reaching for distortions that are the ghosts of melodies he started 20 years ago, perhaps, with Jerry Mulligan. Strange feedback now, to spook his old sidekick with those noises, which announced they were never there in the first place, and then to declare, that's one we call Broken Wing. The title tells one story of a talent broken, strung out in jail more times than he has notes left in his mouthpiece. But the tunes aren't grim. Behind Chet's clerical specs, a death's head blows frivolous trills on a brass horn. Blue notes so oblique, his group can only vamp and vamp and vamp again, a rhythm like applause. Chet's got it tonight. He's on. Even his sweetest clinkers encourage us to believe in inspired eras.
Thanks for reading that, and thanks for being with us.
Thank you.
Richard Ellman has been my guest. He's a poet, novelist, and journalist. You can hear his commentaries on All Things Considered. The book that he just read that poem from is called Homage to Fats Navarro. The book that we discussed earlier is called Cocktails at Somoza's. And his volume of poetry is called Enchantalas, with the poems in Nicaragua that he read for us a little earlier. He's in Philadelphia today because he is now a visiting professor of creative writing at the University of Pennsylvania and journeys to Philadelphia on a weekly basis. Thanks for being with us. I enjoyed it. It's 3:05. This is Fresh Air on WUHY-FM in Philadelphia, and this is Chet Baker. One, two, three.